Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Listen to Fresh Off the Field on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Kam na Māori, bon dia, whatalo fatu, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, the Cook Islands elections see the Cook Islands Party maintain their hold on Parliament as the opposing Democratic Party suffers its worst ever performance. Pacific trade unions say they should be involved in the recruitment process for Pacific workers in Australia and New Zealand after reports of abscondence and exploitation.
We want to continue working with our Australian unions and New Zealand unions so that they help us, because the news goes out in their country, they know more about what's happening in the country with the employers, and they will let us know.
And it's semi-finals day at the OFC Champions League in Fiji, where all eyes are on Vanuatu's Galaxy FC.
We do respect Galaxy. They didn't lose any game during the pool stages, so they're going to be a team to watch as well.
Stay tuned for those stories and more, but I'm your host Aggie Dubois, and our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Whakawhitai lasi, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with the US government pushing forward with plans to sell deep-sea mining leases covering about 67 million acres of seabed around the northern Mariana Islands. It follows last month's announcement that American Samoa's seabed is also slated to be auctioned later this year, as President Trump looks to fast-track seabed mining to secure access to critical minerals and weaken China's grip on the global market. While there's strong opposition in the CNMI to seabed mining, Congresswoman Kimberlyn King-Hines tells reporter Jordan Fennell she's pushing the US government for a 50-50 split of the profits.
So my concern is that this activity will move forward without input of the people who are living here or without consideration of the potential benefits to these islands, right? And so given the fact that we are a non-voting member in Congress and the fight to stop seabed mining from happening in our waters, I think that we should look for areas of opportunities that where this could potentially benefit the people who live here, the people who are living adjacent to where these activities are going to happen. Right now, there is no express language that requires royalty. I think some of the conversations that's happening in American Samoa, for example, anticipate a 1% revenue sharing, and I don't think that's right. What we're seeing with the Gulf states with the oil, I think they're getting a 35.7% revenue sharing, and the rest goes to the United States Department of Treasury. I want to see that same opportunity here while we still have that chance.
Do you have or have you heard estimates for what that 50% revenue could look like in terms of profits from seabed mining?
I don't have those numbers. What I am looking at is, this latest proposal that BOEM has just pushed out. I think what they're doing basically is they've issued a proposed lease notice, right? And so December 16, they're auctioning off, from what I understand, I think 6 or 5 leases. And the starting bid is $3 million, which is not significant, right? And then I think one of the things that they're talking about in as far as royalty is a 2% royalty during the first 5 years of production, and then it moves up to 5% for the first 6 year. We don't really know what those numbers are as of yet, but if we're just looking at them going through the exploratory phase and they're having to pay a minimum of $3 million, right, where does that money go? We want to see it benefit the CNMI, because right now our economy is completely collapsing.
You've said that you have been conflicted about seabed mining itself. Where do you stand on it right now?
So, I'm conflicted because there's a lot we don't know, right? These activities happening just 50 miles outside, closest to our shoreline, that's very concerning to me. And I think we should all be concerned. But also, I don't want to be the party of no, given the fact that there's a lot of information that we still don't have. These leases basically allows these companies to come and do exploration, right? Do surveys of the seafloor, things of that nature, not the actual activity itself. That part of it will give us more data and more solid information so that we can say, is this activity going to be just completely disastrous for our environment?
At the town hall, you said if they're going to shove it, being seabed mining, down our throats, you want to be able to have a backup plan. Are you concerned that the U.S. Is just going to move forward with seabed mining sort of regardless to any opposition, whether that's in CNMI or elsewhere in the Pacific, because, as you say, of those overarching geopolitical forces at play?
I am concerned because, one, where these activities are being proposed sits on the outer continental shelf, and we don't have control over those waters. And so two things can happen here. We can, you know, I can push for legislation saying we don't want these activities. I know that I don't have the numbers because there is support from both sides of the aisle. And so I am a practical person. I look at things from pragmatic perspective. I've been listening to the community and, you know, these environmental folks whose work we appreciate because their voices are important in terms of raising these issues. But if you sit down with the average ordinary Joe right now who is looking to get furloughed next fiscal year because the government is not generating any revenue, or if you're looking at people paying these outrageous utility prices and the utilities asking for $40 million to be able to just stay afloat, or if you're talking about teachers and students who now only go to school 4 days out of the week, if you're talking to the community who only has three cops, people are looking at just being realistic about what are ways where we can help ourselves instead of constantly going to the federal government and asking for federal handout. It's a tough situation to be in, right? But, you know, what's tougher is, you know, going to the federal government and asking for things to be changed, you know, when they're going a certain direction.
And that's CNMI Congresswoman Kimberlyn King-Hines speaking to reporter Jordan Fennell. All right, as the dust settles on the Cook Islands general election, one thing is clear. The Cook Islands Party remains the dominant force in the country's politics. With 12 seats secured and just one more MP needed to guarantee a parliamentary majority, Mark Brown is all but assured of another term as Prime Minister. The big story of the election was the collapse of the Democratic Party. Once the main opposition force, the party has lost all of its seats. It's the worst performance in its 54-year history. Meanwhile, the Cook Islands United Party has strengthened its position, increasing its representation in Parliament and emerging as the main opposition party. So joining us now is Te Ariki Heather, leader of the Cook Islands United Party, to discuss what the result means for the country's political future. With that, I say popongi mā nea, Te Ariki, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Kia rana, kia rana.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Te Ariki, I understand the ruling CIP, of course, is positioned to form this government for a fifth term. Were you surprised at all about this year's general election results?
Well, very surprised and quite disappointing as well in that sense, Aggie, simply because disappointed that we did everything under the sun to actually sort of promote the United Party and, of course, our policies. But surprised the people chose the government of today and for the next 4 years again.
Yeah, and I suppose with that disappointment, a lot of people have, and I've seen online, have spoken about whether or not there should have been a collaboration with your party and maybe the Democratic Party. Do you think that would have served you better in a way, maybe to have at least ousted the CIP so that you would have seen the change you wanted for the Cook Islands?
Yes, we proposed that measure, but unfortunately the leadership of the Democratic Party didn't agree or accept that proposal, and this is sort of the second time and lesson learned for them as well.
Well, I understand with your party, it had 15 candidates. Overall, though, how did they actually do this year?
Well, overall, they did very well, you know, but they sort of like say very well because this is the first time they've ever joined politics and it's the first time all the committees that's got involved. So they are, called, I would say, newbies to this political arena. But totally sort of like accepted the challenge that they face, and of course their people. But I think that's one of the areas that people didn't sort of like might have the respect or appreciation of these new faces, new people that are actually joining the political arena for that.
Yes, and then, Te Reki, I understand your party, I had mentioned in the intro, has strengthened its position, you know, increasing its representation in Parliament. Can you share with us how many seats did your party secure, though?
Well, we've secured 4 at the moment, so pending on the one independent candidate seat and also the one of ours in the Ngatangi electorate, pending on the outcome of the final votes in that area. So that's sort of like the numbers we need, because we need 5 and actually sort of appreciate at this time for the support the people have given to all our candidates, but more so now we're becoming the major opposition, and of course acquiring a office of the opposition, that's a great achievement for us in just 4 years.
Absolutely, and I'm thinking, you know, with the 5 that you need, are you quite confident that will come through for your team?
Oh, yes, I'm confident in that area. Like I mentioned before, there's 2 of them. One that actually sort of crossed the line in that one. And so that's 5 for us. But until the declaration from the electoral office, so that's confirmation, there might be sort of like 6 votes or advance votes or whatever the final result for that one. But yes, we need 5 actually under our constitution to obtain that office.
Te Reki, I understand that you are also wanting to file an electoral petition. Why is this? And I suppose I ask that because is there any chance that will actually go through? I mean, do you feel like the people have spoken and they've voted for who they really wanted to be the government this year?
Well, it's not the petition that, you know, in that sense, what really is happening on the ground, sort of especially for one of the town members that actually holds the ministerial post today, because as soon as the election was called, he was still trimming trees around that electoral office. That's the one we're filing a petition for. So, the hope is that, you know, justice must prevail in this instance, regardless what position you hold in the present government. And we feel that's been sort of treating and bribing the people this time, especially in that electorate in town.
Okay. And I understand you've also really described the current government as one that has a very strained relationship with New Zealand. So if we're looking internationally, do you think this will continue, though, despite them winning the elections again?
Well, I think for overall, there's a lot of major issues that we raised during our campaign. And this is one thing, the people were all in support of that. And then, so I say disappointment, because they voted for the same government. They were actually sort of doing all this against what the people's wishes, because this government never listened to the people. And the other surprise why I say and so disappointment as well, because we sort of promoted all what they said, the border tariffs, the seabed mining, and of course the passport and other issues that was of concern to the people. But still now the people still voted the government in. And one of the major ones is our citizens with New Zealand, because he's never let that one sort of like it's done, finished, and over. It's on the table. So that's the scary part for me. And of course, for the people to learn what they've actually put this government back for. So it's sort of, let's see and wait what happens in the next sort of 4 years for us.
Well, with no more Democratic Party, Te Reki, your party really is set to be that opposition party right now. As the leader, what do you think your priorities are now? Like, how do you think you will keep the government accountable?
Well, obtaining an office, and because maybe you're unaware, but we've been operating since 22 without an office, without a budget as well. So it's been difficult in that sense. Now, democratically elected, like all the members, but under our constitution, this is what I've argued in Parliament, and of course with the Clerk and Speaker of Parliament, not allowing us that's been elected. But that's the position now. And we propose to change all that with becoming government, giving each political party the opportunity to partake in the politics of the Cook Islands. And that restriction remains, it's a thorn in the backside, really, to say. But we have operated in our 22 election right up to date without a budget. But we've proven and shown to the people, especially in Wakapuekura, in our district, that without the budget, we were able to serve our people with a disability van, and of course with a police vehicle as well, and then many other things that we will partake during that period of time. So we got our people in support of everything we did. So now, still saying, the fight we get, then we obtain an office, and then that's the we had a great meeting, big meeting last night. We're going to hold the government accountable to what they've actually produced. And having the opposition office with all the resources and funding as well, we will be able to do that. We couldn't do that before because we were not allocated any budget because we only had three at the time.
Well, I do want to ask then, what's your position on, because, you know, a lot has been talked about cost of living there in the Cook Islands, and even what's your position on seabed mining?
Well, seabed mining, we said no to seabed mining. Yeah, the research can carry on, but we absolutely say, you know, we don't want to touch our seabed because the impact it would have and the consequences the people receive. We might have all the wealth in the world for this, and then sort of what happens? Are we able to repair that? But evidence has been shown to us by the same people that actually in one of these ones, Mona Minerals, that it took 1 million years to actually get these magnetodes and the richness in them today. So the big question for us in the United Party unanimously said no, the impact would cause a particular harm, and we believe it will, and let's leave it alone for the generations, the future of our young people to enjoy. And this is one of the key reasons, is the impact it would have and how we're going to repair that. And we might lose all that and the fish and everything else and an environment impact would have. So it's not about the wealth, but also one of the key concerns our people has is using this for the sake of military. And that's the reason why China and America is very much interested in our manganese nodules. And this is one thing our people, you know, we have a Christian nation, Christian faith as well. So we are saying, whole of the United Party, since we started this, and of course Dr. Tina Romo has been very instrumental in giving us good advice because as a, you know, the first Cook Islander, so we take our lead from him and we supported all the protests he has done. So it's that we don't want to sort of be part of a country that, you know, call our Lord Jesus Christ our Savior. And then we're supplying this material to actually make military equipment, you know, killing innocent people in that sense. So keep them out of here. And then, you know, we've been sort of enjoying the luxury of our ocean and in our environment, you know, for the last 61 years being in government. So why spoil it? That's our stance for that one.
Yeah. And so moving forward, though, Te Ariki, from this moment, what are you and the party, what are your plans moving forward? Sorry.
Well, it's consolidation, and consolidation and also a succession plan. And meaning, last night it was endorsed and enforced for everybody. Actually, you know, we understand, start work now and start sort of like serving our people now. And like I said before, these are all newcomers, but they put their hands up to serve the people of the Cook Islands. And that's why I'm very much grateful for all of them. And I know each and every one of them, they have been, lived in the Cook Islands, they have gone abroad, came back with the knowledge, and you know, the likes of Liz Iro, that's my sister. She's been the WHO and sort of like in a very high position for all the diseases of 23 million, but also have been in the health area, served the country as well, 35 years. And that's another sort of disappointment for me. You know, she would have been an Uncle Tena Rongo. And this is the combination of all the candidates of the Cook Islands United Party. Really, these are people that went abroad, gained a lot of knowledge, and also they're able to come back here and serve our people. But our people see otherwise and also supported the Cook Islands Party government. So for us, it's always stability and also a succession plan for us. And we start working now and look forward to the 2030 election. Hence, for me, for us, it's not sort of getting everybody to the independent candidates to form a government. It's not about the power. It's about to serve our people. And that's the reason why we've taken stance on, we'll take the office and work our way through that for the next 4 years.
Yes, well, it sounds like you still got some fight in you, Te Ariki, so it's good to hear that. So we appreciate you coming on the show this morning. Me taki.
Me taki maata. all the best to the people of the Cook Islands. God bless. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. That is Te Ariki Heather, leader of the Cook Islands United Party here on Pacific Beat.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Pacific trade unions say they should be involved in the recruitment of workers from Pacific countries to work in Australia and New Zealand's labour schemes. More than 30,000 Pacific Islanders are engaged in the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, or PALM, while a further 20,000 are in New Zealand's own scheme. But in recent years, there have been reports of workers absconding from the scheme and employers exploiting workers. Jadika Sharma from the Fiji Trade Unions Congress says unions must be part of the recruitment process to ensure the right workers are selected and prepared for the job ahead. She says unions can also verify employers so no unscrupulous companies are recruiting in the region.
One of the major constraints that we face in this area of work is that we don't have data. Our structures are loose in terms of how we manage data, how we record data at source. So how many people are going, how many are going in which industry, how many are male, how many are young workers, and what are the issues that they face on the other side, and how do we address those issues so that we can give a snapshot of what the situation is like, whether it's working for the country, whether it's working for the workers. All the time we hear that workers have earn this much money because the wage rate is high. On the other side, they come back, they build their small businesses, they extend their homes. But then the other part, yeah, the social impact, the impact of staying away from young families, from elderly parents, I think it has to be balanced. Yeah, even though you're getting remittance for your country, for yourself. But on the other side, what are you losing? Yeah, what is at stake? Yeah, some families break up. Some people end up on the streets. We have heard some also mention that there are many workers that, because of issues with the employers, they leave their employment and they don't know what to do, where to go. And if they have still visas valid, they stay in Australia here and they are doing odd jobs or at family's place and they wait to be deported. Yeah, but we don't want our countrymen to end in another country with that, in that kind of situation.
So what are the workers' unions saying with, in terms of the treatments that they were getting from working in Australia and New Zealand? And what is the approach you think will be the best approach for all the countries to take to address that?
I think the proper management of the whole system is important. The sending countries need to ensure that there is government-to-government agreements that specify how their workers will be managed on the other side. What kind of employers come and recruit workers from our countries? I think that is also very important. We at the FTUC have been asking the government that we be involved in the recruitment process as well. We also want to see how employers select the workers so we can prepare the workers better in terms of selection. We can inform them what they need to have before the employers come and select you. And while they're doing this process, we would want to be there vigilant, yeah, to see what kind of employers are there, what they are telling our workers. So if there is an employer who has a bad record in terms of violation of human rights, workers' rights, they should not be allowed back into the system. They should be held responsible. Yeah, we heard just today that there was an employer that did not look after the workers well, and then he closed business. Nobody was able to do anything. He abandoned the workers, and then he has opened another business. Right, he has gone and joined another employer, and they are doing the recruitment and the hiring. What changes when the owners are the same? So we were told that what came out of the conversations with the authorities was that people change. Yeah, but what is the guarantee there that when once some of the workers have been left, I think it was about 30 workers affected, now that person or that employer is not going to do the same thing. So we want unions, the Pacific unions, to be included in the employer profiling. The employers that get licensed to come and recruit workers, the direct labor hire agencies where most of the exploitation takes place, we want to know who these people are, whether they should be allowed, and we want to continue working with our Australian unions and New Zealand unions so that they help us, because the news goes out in their country, they know more about what's happening in the country with the employers, and they will let us know, okay, this employer should not be allowed to recruit because he has committed this. He had not paid overtime, he had not paid full wages, yeah, to the workers, and those are the employers that should no longer be allowed to recruit to be there. And one of the strategies that we have decided is that we are going to have a Pacific Islands Council Trade Union Executive Board meeting shortly in Fiji, where we are going to inform them, this has come out of this workshop here, these are the recommendations, these are the future steps that we need to look into. And as the Pacific Council of Trade Unions, we have to take a position and push for DFET, for DIWA, for MFET to take stock of what actually are they doing.
And that there is Jadika Sharma, Fiji Trade Unions Congress, and she was speaking there to our reporter, Lily Rose Walwell. Pacific Beat. Okay, Dr. Ananapa has made a name for herself as a political scientist, regional security expert, and a Pacific scholar. Now she's heading the secretariat of the Melanesian Spearhead Group Secretariat, a sub-regional political body made up of Papua New Guinea, Fiji, Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, and the FLNKS from New Caledonia. Her appointment has been celebrated as a milestone for gender leadership in a region where such appointments are rare. But even in her homeland, there's been a negative reaction, with members of the Council of Chiefs calling for her appointment to be revoked. Vanuatu's Prime Minister and the public threw their support behind Dr. Ananapa, but what's made her the most proud is that she is the first Nivan to take up the prestigious post.
I'm the first Nivanuatu to be at the helm of the MSG Secretariat. I'm certainly not the first Nivanuatu, obviously, to have a very important role. Vanuatu, historically, played a key part in the foundation of the MSG through then Prime Minister Walter Lini in the 1980s and his group of advisors, which also included the current president of Vanuatu, Nikiniki Buruburavu.
And even as a woman, right, what impacts do you think this has on the other women who are wanting to step into places of leadership, or even, yeah, what does this mean in regards to regional leadership too?
It's an absolute privilege and an enormous honour to be appointed as the first female Director General to the Melanesia Spearhead Group. And it's an honour and a privilege, not only personally and professionally, but because of that very question you asked, Aggie, and that it gives recognition to every Melanesian woman and girl. And it shows that women can also be in leadership roles at a regional level. This doesn't come through easy pathways. And I think this is where we recognise that the practice of leadership is an exercise, not merely a position. And the practice of leadership is only enabled by those around us and those who've lent their support. So for myself personally, this milestone is made possible, you know, through my own parents, my husband Nick, my children, my extended family, my customary elders and leaders, you know, friends, colleagues and mentors. And I know that for everybody who is on a leadership journey.
And that's the thing, when you step into such a role, our listeners are probably thinking, what then are your immediate priorities?
My immediate priorities are renewing those core objectives, founding objectives of the Melanesian Spearhead Group. And our twin objectives, if you like, are around politics and trade. And these are cornerstones of the work that we've done and since inception. And so my focus is guided by the founding principles and purpose of the MSG with regards decolonisation, with regards trade and economic integration. You know, part of that process of returning to our core objectives also means looking at how do we embark on an institutional renewal? How do we ensure that we are, as a group and as a secretariat, serving our members, that we are ready, able and agile to support our members navigate quite turbulent at times geopolitical context, quite challenging global economic crises, amongst obviously the biggest crisis of all, climate change. How can we be the best we can be to support our members through this?
Which I have to ask, Anna, you know, you talk about the noise of the world, but yet there seems to have been a bit of noise within your own world there in Vanuatu. I have to ask that there was that issue around the Mawatu Māori Council of Chiefs, who put out that statement, you know, calling for your revocation from the Director General role of MSG. I mean, were you even surprised by this? What was your reaction to that?
Firstly, that day that it came out, I don't know whether it was divine intervention or not, but my phone wasn't working. I had poor connectivity, so I didn't get the barrage of information until a bit partway through that day. I had been pre-warned or pre-informed that an article was coming out. And had been invited to comment, and I had declined commenting because I had not personally seen any statement, and the way it was couched was the statement was to the Vanuatu government, and it was therefore appropriate for the Vanuatu government to respond, not myself, given that I hadn't seen anything. So it was really heartwarming to see the response, not only of the Vanuatu government, but so many people from around Vanuatu, to also see the response when an interview was given, I believe, to the MSG chair, who also reiterated support for gender equality. It opened up a conversation that is important to have, and for that I'm quite appreciative of not only the fact that Office of the Prime Minister in Vanuatu and the Prime Minister of Fiji were so supportive of my appointment and spoke positively and in support of gender equality, but also the people of Vanuatu spoke too. On a personal note, my own personal background, I'm very deeply steeped in my cultural heritage, and my thesis that I recently completed is all about custom and diplomacy. And I'd worked with the Malvatu Maori. I've worked with them very closely over close to 20 years now in various capacities. So I think for those who may not be as familiar with me or my background, that perhaps is how it played out, in a way of people not really being fully familiar with the context of my own work around the custom and custom governance, you know, I'm one of the first who would recognise customary authority in most contexts. So I think there's a learning of who I am that is still happening. But it was wonderful to do I had planned, and we did do a customary protocol to the traditional custodians of the place where the MSG Secretariat is in Port Vila. And that is the Te Riki Pani Manu, Kalsa Kau III of Ifira, Te Nuku. So we did a huge customary ceremony with them as one of my first priority engagements, because for me, fundamentally, and this is the Melanesian way, is we give respect to the place where we are, the place where we seek to work from the custodians of that place.
And that there is Dr. Ananalpa, Director General of the Melanesian Spearhead Group. Now, I had a very interesting chat with her, and you can listen to the longer version by heading over to ABC Pacific to find today's Pacific Beat episode. Now, it's been a full-on morning, and if you've just joined us, Malo Abido, this is Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. Here's just a quick recap of what's been on the show so far. The US government is pushing forward with its plans to sell deep-sea mining leases, covering about 67 million acres of seabed around the Northern Mariana Islands. Also, the Cook Islands Party maintain their hold on Parliament as the opposing Democratic Party suffers its worst ever performance. Pacific trade unions say they should be involved in the recruitment process for Pacific workers in Australia and New Zealand. But still to come, it's semi-finals day of the OFC Champions League in Fiji, where all eyes are on Vanuatu's Galaxy FC. But right now, it's time for your news wrap. Yes, kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Goodness, it's time to head around the region to get the latest headlines. That's brought to you by our producer, Dana Kirimoff, who's in the studio with me this morning. Good morning. How are we doing?
Good morning, Aggie. I'm doing well. How are you?
Hi, Ma.
We're here.
Yeah, we're here. Absolutely. And we're nearly actually at the end of the show, which is really surprising. But before we do finish off, we've got a couple of stories here. This one I felt, wow, very interesting. And good things come to those who wait. And why do I say that? Because Samoa has just sworn in one of their longest serving members to cabinet. Who is this?
Yeah, so Te Ato Ala Peato was sworn in as Samoa's newest cabinet minister yesterday at the young age of 87.
Wow.
Now, Minister Peato is the 15th member of Cabinet and has been appointed as the minister responsible for the Legislative Assembly and the Office of the Ombudsman.
Wow. Look, Minister Peato might be new to the Cabinet position, but like we said, he's certainly not new to Parliament. How far back does his service go?
Now, his parliamentary history reaches back to 1982, which is 18 years before I was born.
Wow. So that makes me even more older than
And before his elevation to Cabinet, Taya was serving as the Associate Minister of Lands and Survey. So he's been Cabinet adjacent, but his appointment fills the Cabinet spot that has been vacant since March of this year when former Deputy Prime Minister Tuilupe Onesimo stepped down from Cabinet following a Supreme Court ruling that he was connected to a $150 vote bribe in the 2025 general election.
Wow. Well, that's unfortunate for that person, but look, I must say congratulations to, of course, Peato for just at the young age of 87, making Cabinet. Well done, well done. Look, let's head to Fiji now, where an Australian citizen has been sentenced to 21 years imprisonment. This is after being convicted of possessing more than 1 kilogram of cocaine. Goodness.
Yeah, so Bainivalu Suturanga was sentenced after being found guilty of 2 counts of unlawful possession of illicit drugs, as reported by the Fiji Times. Now, this case started during a police patrol in Saweni in February of 2024. The police subsequently found 7.9 grams of cocaine in a suspicious vehicle, and that led them to a hotel room with a bag, which after testing was revealed to have contained 1.02 kilograms of cocaine. Now, the High Court judge, Sunil Sharma, found the quantity of cocaine indicated involvement in a larger supply chain rather than just possession for personal use.
Oh, wow. Okay, well then, more than just the punishment for this particular crime, Dana, this sentence is a message, though, right, for other would-be drug offenders.
Yeah, so in his judgment, Justice Sharma said that this sentence acts as both general and specific deterrence. He said that he was sending a clear warning to all that any breach of the law relating to drugs will not be tolerated, and that no leniency will be extended to the offenders. Now, Saturanga must serve a minimum of 17 years before becoming eligible for parole, and he has 30 days to appeal in the Court of Appeal should he wish to do so.
Goodness, goodness. All right. Well, staying in Fiji, where littering is soon going to become more trouble than it's worth. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, talk about deterrence. So an amendment to Fiji's litter laws will see the penalty for littering quintupled from $40 to $200 Fijian dollars, which is set to be implemented in about 2 weeks. Okay. Now, speaking in Parliament yesterday, the Minister for Information, Environment and Climate Change, Linda Tabuya, said that the increase was not about revenue for the government, but the prevention of the crime. She also said that they'd rather collect $0 in litter fines, but that the fine would only be effective with proper enforcement.
Okay, well, what does proper enforcement actually look like then?
Yeah, well, in the same speech, the minister said that the government is strengthening the network of litter prevention officers and that the enforcement and the success of the enforcement will be measured through the tracking of notices issued and then behaviour change over time.
Right. Do you think this, I mean, could work. I mean, I have this conversation because is it China or Singapore that just has pristine roads?
I think it's
roads?
Singapore.
It's Singapore,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
So having clean streets is possible.
Well, yes, but I think we have very strong litter laws here in Australia, and I don't think they work. So yeah. Who's to say?
Yes. All right. Well, we will definitely wait and see about this story. But again, as always, Dana, thank you very much for bringing the news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Join Natasha Matin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores the issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
The cyclone Malia came on hard. Rain, wind was blowing hard, almost like taking off the roofs. It was one kind of a disaster that we experienced for the first time.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges, from how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fafatai lover, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Let's head into the world of sport now. It's semi-finals day at the OFC Champions League in Fiji. And on the evidence of the tournament so far, there could be a changing of the guard on the cards. The first semi features title holders Auckland City taking on host club Rewa FC, to be followed by Solomon Islands Central Coast up against the team of the moment, Vanuatu's Galaxy FC. As Richard Hewitt reports, while Auckland scrambled out of their group thanks to some very late goals, Galaxy flew through, scoring 14 times and conceding just 3.
Surrey! The icing on the cake! Bartram Surrey!
Galaxy FC's head coach Bartram Surrey played 48 times for Solomon Islands, scoring 15 goals for his country. But as he prepares to lead his Vanuatu club side against Honiara-based Central Coast, there is clearly no room for sentiments with the place in the Champions League final at stake.
It's a business. I'm here for Galaxy. So I'm Vanuatuan now. Playing against a club from my country is not easy. We have to prepare well for it. And so, yes, we are ready to play against Central. Win against them will be a big bonus, but we have to work very, very hard and do a lot of sacrifice and commitment. Big game for us.
As was evident after they sealed their semi-final place with a win over Tigerspor, there is plenty of passion in the Central Coast camp, but coach Jacob Mori is taking a measured approach to the task ahead.
We do respect Galaxy. They didn't lose any game during the pool stages, so they're going to be a team to watch as well. So we just have to go back to training and work on the things that we need to work on.
But if Central Coast are to make a Champions League final, they'll have to stop Galaxy's world record breaker Medina, who will no doubt be hunting his fourth hat-trick in a row.
Here comes the cross. Oh, it's in! Just like that! Wonderful strike! Medina times it well, chests it through, and Medina gets a double. Nice work from Batu, inside for Medina, just tapped away there. Medina again, another hat-trick for him. How good is this man?
Meanwhile, the host nation are being urged to get behind Rewa when they take on perennial title holders Auckland. Player coach Davita Waranavalu is quietly confident of finding a way past a side that has had to dig deep in every one of their games so far.
Our start in the tournament was not that good, but even though we went down in the first game, we still held our heads high. We regrouped, worked things out, and we managed to get into the semi-final because our teamwork, our bond. Auckland City is a good team. You can see all the games they won in the dying stages. That's where the depth in the bench came in. Whoever comes in with a positive mindset, positive attitude, will surely do good in the day.
And Auckland's assistant coach Ivan Visalic doesn't deny that City have found the going tough, but in what he says is a very even competition, he's hailing his side's squad depth as a key factor.
Goes to show we've got that fitness and mobility to get back into the game and get the result. Our subs are really important for us coming to help change a game. So, you know, it's been a real team effort for us in the first three games of the group, and it goes to show that everyone within the squad is really valued. There's quality right through the tournament, and we can't take any game easy, so it's going to be very difficult. Home support is going to be an added pressure for us.
And Rewa are very keen to tap into that home advantage. Crowds have been small so far, but they're urging football followers to turn up in big numbers this time. Davita Waranavalu says the Drua have their 16th man on the rugby field, and he wants Rewa's 12th man to rock the stands in Bar.
Rewa is representing Fiji. Come on down and support us. Support the team that has been working hard throughout the tournament. And your support will really motivate us. Your support will give us the boost and also be our 12th man in the field.
The number of fans back in Galaxy and Central Coast will be small but very vocal. And the fans of the Ireland teams all have one thing in common. That's to see an Ireland team win the OFC Champions League for just the third time in 19 years.
And that's Richard Hewitt with that preview of the OFC Champions League semi-finals, with Rewa versus Auckland City kicking off at 3 p.m. Fiji time, to be followed by Galaxy versus Central Coast at 7 p.m.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
And finally, the island of Saipan in the Northern Marianas was one of the hardest hit by Typhoon Sinlaku earlier this year. The super typhoon's winds not only caused destruction, but they also cleared the way for a new discovery. Vladislav Melnik was out for his morning run when he spotted an opening he'd never seen before. It took Vlad, a self-styled explorer, 6 hours of cutting through dense jungle to reach the site. But when he did, he found himself transported back in time, surrounded by American and Japanese World War II artifacts that appear to have been untouched since 1944.
I have a morning jogging, takes me up to the summit. I usually stop in the summit a few minutes stretching. But that morning, what I saw, it was very different. The typhoon had altered the vegetation enough to open the site that simply hadn't existed before. I spotted some particular cave. And of course, curiosity immediately got the better of me. Why postpone the good adventure to another day? As soon as I reached the site, the object began to appear. That's already, I got excited and I went inside. It wasn't one spectacular object. The place started revealing itself, piece by piece.
Yeah, what was the first thing that you saw?
Oh, it was a Japanese canteen. Yeah, and then the next, it was the kettle. Yeah, and then when I step inside, wow, it was American and Japanese wartime. The items, bottles, medical items, personal equipment, the weapon parts, part of the boots, leather gear, and actually one object, then another, and eventually you have the moment when you realize, all right, that's isn't random. The site itself, it's beginning to speak. It was really interesting, this cool moment. I had many times. It wasn't my first cave. I found in numerous caves on Saipan.
If you regularly find these caves and you find artifacts in these caves, what do you do with them afterwards?
Just nothing. I love to see it. As you can imagine, it's a time capsule. You can feel how they sleep, what's the danger, what's the feeling. You can believe, a few months earlier, I found the human remainings and the ring with the name on it. There's a name. I did some research. I found the name. It's from Okinawa. Imagine it's a person. It was a woman. And that's why I'm saying it's sacred.
And do you know if the ring ended up with someone or what happened to it?
Oh, no. I keep it. I still have it because I was hoping, I sent multiple emails and messages, including the Japanese consulate here, but they were just standard emails. That's another reason that a lot of people asking, share coordinates. I did 15 years ago. And unfortunately, when I back, some of the caves is not vandalized, but some items, some of the relics and the artifacts is gone. So, and I said, no, I'm not going to share unless it's official request.
Maybe not, but I kind of would have assumed some kind of museum or something would have wanted to have it.
Yeah, that's the, I have a mixed feeling. If you don't touch anything, it's going to be disappeared anyway. The time it's going to destroy it. But I'm not a collector. I don't have that instinct to simply acquire things and put them on the shelf. For me, it's more interesting because of what I can tell me about the place. It's my way.
And that is Vladislav Melnik speaking to Dana Kerimov. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Let's look back at some of our main stories today. The recent Cook Islands election saw the collapse of the Democratic Party and the emergence of the Cook Islands United Party as the main opposition party.
We've proven and shown to the people, especially in Wakapue, in our district, that without the budget we were able to serve our people.
And also the destruction of Typhoon Sinlaku led to the discovery of a trove of World War II artifacts in Saipan.
it wasn't one spectacular object. The play started revealing itself, like piece by piece.
All right, our team will be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next, it's your news, and coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, o toa whaato. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.